With David Hyde, I'm Marcy Silman. Dina Magetsu is a writer and a 2012 MacArthur Award winner. In his new book, he interweaves two seemingly different stories across two different continents.
It's called All Our Names, and it draws parallels between the perceived successes of two different movements, the civil rights movement in small-town USA and the independence movement in post-colonial Africa. Dina Magetsu told our colleague Steve Scheer that he was drawn to the great optimism he saw in Nigeria, especially at the university in the country's capital, and that optimism was the foundation for the novel's narrator, Isaac.
That idea is really what helped me locate the story in Kampala, was because I wanted that optimism. I wanted that idea that this is where a young man would go to make something of himself.
Yeah, you wrote that you were looking at people who were reinventing themselves because they were free to do so in the aftermath of independence. But then you told the, I think it was the Tribune, it evolved and took on another voice.
Yeah, because, I mean, part of it is there is that great optimism. And you know, when I knew when the story began that way, that optimism was definitely going to be tinged with the disappointment that follows, right? So there's a great moment of hope, and eventually you realize that that hope is sort of slowly crushed by the tyrants and the dictators that came into power. And as I did that narrative, I realized that there was an echo between that story and what happened here in the U.S. at the same time. So then this voice of this woman, Helen, emerged, and that became the second part of the narrative, was trying to tell the story of a woman and a young man falling in love together in early 1970. He's in a small town in the Midwest.
So the falling away of optimism, the falling away of the hope that followed the first civil rights efforts, the first efforts to see equality for women, those
exactly.
sorts of things?
Yeah, there are amazing parallels that happen. So you have 1962, Uganda becomes independent. 1963, we have the March on Washington. We also have the independence of Kenya and many other African nations. 1968, you have the death of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy and the riots that follow. By 1969, 1970, you have the rise of tyrants in Africa. You have these men who were once great heroes and leaders becoming dictators and starting to turn their power on against their own people.
And in the States?
And then in the States, you have this sort of, I think, the frustration that the civil rights movement had made enormous progress, but then once the riots happened, you realize that there's this huge economic disparity still left behind that hadn't been resolved, and that while the sort of overt systems of racism might have been tempered, that what happens on a day-to-day scale, what happens when a black man and a white woman go into a restaurant, as they do in the story, and they see themselves not overtly discriminated against, but sort of diminished and cruelly diminished by the gestures of others, you realize that those things aren't so easily won, that there's still a lingering malaise, a lingering frustration that the civil rights movement wasn't able to complete.
So I ask, how do you think the people are shaped by that malaise?
I would say that they arrive and they begin the story full of hope, and then slowly that hope is coupled with a frustrating disappointment. And what emerges out of that disappointment for me is the way these characters begin to search for some form of love that can sort of redeem them through that. So there's a strong current of the ways in which we latch on to one another, whether it's as friends or as lovers, that becomes our saving grace.
But you mean that, our saving grace,
yeah,
right?
Very much so.
Yeah. There's a section in the book where Helen and the man we come to know as Isaac are going into the diner.
Yeah.
Before you read it a little bit, set up your thinking in that. What was Helen going through? Yeah. She seems very naive in some ways.
She is. She's very naive. It's, you know, the early 1970s, and she wants to see if she can make this relationship a part of a larger narrative. She wants to see if this man that she's beginning to fall in love with, if the two of them can't provoke some sort of change. And there's definitely naivete about that, but there's also this idea that this is the man that she's learning to fall in love with, and inevitably you want to move that relationship out of the private. You want to move that into the public sphere. You want to be able to say, this is my partner, this is the man I'm with, or this is the woman I'm with. And I think the more optimistic or better side of her wants to do that. She doesn't want to hide. She doesn't want to live in fear of the fact that people won't like the fact that she's dating this man.
Helen's a social worker, young yeah. social worker. The man we know as Isaac has come as a
foreign exchange student loosely.
Yeah, yeah. But he's leaving. Yeah. We find out he's leaving a situation yeah. where chaos has erupted. And you describe it as a border town
yeah.
between north and south, between urban and rural, between obvious and less obvious bigotry?
Yeah. So it's a town set very much in the Midwest, sort of loosely based on my own experiences of growing up in Peoria after leaving Ethiopia as a young child. So I was interested in that middle ground that we occupy, not only geographically, but definitely sort of psychologically and emotionally, a place that doesn't have the sort of overt progressive ideas of the Northeast, but then at the same time doesn't have the sort of deeply entrenched discrimination of the South, that sort of that strange gray area that I think we really live in most of the time.
Yeah, we Westerners sort of take pride that we think we're We're beyond racism and we're beyond bias. And yet, of course, we swirl in it like everyone else.
Like everyone else it does. And we don't have oftentimes the proper language to express that, which is oftentimes the thing that interests me the most as a writer. Not so much that we all commit small acts of bigotry probably in our lives, but how we choose and whether or not we have the words in order to demonstrate that and to overcome it at the same time. So in this case, you can see these characters struggling under this discrimination, but no one ever says any of those words. There's never a hostile word spoken. It's the gestures that do all the intimidation.
Yeah, the most painful kind of prejudice in many ways, right? Will you read a little bit of that?
With pleasure.
And they're in the diner at this point, and they've ordered their meal.
Isaac had finished his omelet by the time my order arrived on the standard cream-colored plates used for everyone other than him. The waitress tried to walk away quickly, but I grabbed her wrist and told her I wanted to cancel my order. Tell Bill I don't want to eat here. The poor child. She was struggling not to cry. We didn't make it any easier on her. Leave the plate, Isaac said to her. We're going to stay and eat it. She hurried back to the kitchen. I stared at the plate of chicken and mashed potatoes and blinked twice, childishly hoping I could make it vanish. Please, I said to him. Let's leave now. He shook his head no. Not until we finish our lunch, he said. That's what you wanted, isn't it? If that was his way of settling the score, then I thought I could play along just as well. For the next 10 minutes, I slowly took my food apart. With my first half-hearted stab into the chicken, all the momentum was gone. There was nothing we could change. I felt a regression back to my mother's kitchen table, where I'd spent many nights and afternoons laboring to finish a meal that my father had never shown up for, and that my mother had refused. I had always known that there was something cruel in her insistence that I eat every bite on my plate while my father's food grew cold next to me. She needed a victim besides herself. And when I finally looked up at Isaac after a few minutes and saw him smiling at me, I knew there was something slightly cruel lurking in his gaze.
Tanam and Gestu is reading from his book, All Our Names. So is that what was happening? Was he making her the victim besides himself?
Definitely. I wanted them both to be culpable in that moment. And in this particular scene, you can see the way in which Isaac is trying to defend himself and hold his ground, and the only way to do so is, for him at least in this case, is to take it out on her, is to create another victim. So he knows that he is being discriminated against. He knows that he is being the victim in this situation. But to some degree, he's also forcing her to participate in it so she can know what that feels like. He doesn't want to let her off the hook. He doesn't want her to say that it's okay, we can go, but that you have to experience this with me. You have to be a part of the story.
Yeah, and also that he is sort of forcing on her an acknowledgement that he recognizes the politics of what she's engaged
in. Yeah, and that he recognizes them perhaps more intimately, more profoundly than she does, even though he's new to the country. He has to be more aware of it. He can't pretend to be naive the same way she can. And that comes with a sort of greater knowledge and also a greater strength in some ways for him as well.
Yeah, but he comes from a place where he also was living sort of a fantasy, an ideal of what it could be to be an educated young man in a hopeful country, while all around him discrimination is rampant.
Of course. And that same discrimination that happens in this diner in the Midwest is very much echoed by that economic discrimination in Kampala in Uganda. So it's not to say that the discrimination that happens here in the U.S. is some sort of awful privileged thing that only we have been subject to, but that really when you bring it down to that personal level, you'll see it mirrored constantly in other countries, in other places, in other times. And so Isaac, even before coming to the Midwest, knows what it's like to be discriminated against, not because of the color of the skin, but because he can't afford a cup of tea.
Yeah. What is his name?
His name is the name that he takes on for himself. Part of the idea of the novel is that characters are reforming and reimagining their own identity. And for him, I think the name that he adopts, the name that he assumes, is the name that he has finally made for himself. And so he can only be that. He may have been born with other names, but none of those names are as relevant as the one that he has, that has been sacrificed and given to him.
Where does that idea come from? Is that part of the idea you're talking about, of the optimism and then the change or disappointment of
Definitely.
Countries?
And it's also a very quintessentially American idea. When you think about the history of immigrants coming to Ellis Island, one of the first things that they did was change their names. So I was really fascinated by that idea that by changing your name, you're allowing yourself the sort of possibility of reimagining yourself, reinventing yourself on the optimistic side. On the negative side, of course, are the losses that come with having to do so. And so you're trying to work through those two sides of the story. But really, I'd say the idea began with a very sort of American sensibility that what happens when you come here is you can, and many people have historically done that in order to move themselves forward.
But of course, Isaac, who's narrating this story along with Helen, comes to have that name because of his relationship to somebody else he knows whose name is Isaac. Describe those two men and their relationship.
They are they're young strivers. You know, they're two men who come to a college campus for very different reasons, but both of them imagine that this world, this campus, this place will be more open and more embracing to them than it actually is. So they come full of fantasies and dreams, one to sort of lead a political movement or revolution, the other one to become a writer. And they converge on this idea that they are full of aspirations, but those aspirations are slowly being drained from them bit by the political reality, by the economic reality of their lives. And what emerges instead is this sort of deep, profound friendship that then gets tested under the most kind of extreme circumstances that I could think of.
And you did indeed.
Thank you. I guess.
How do you imagine, not giving anything away, how do you imagine the three characters as they aged, as they go beyond those tests into their the settled nature of what happens as we get into our 40s.
I do imagine a rather better future for all of them to some degree, as much as it's possible. But definitely for sort of Helen and the narrator, Isaac, I imagine them not drifting off into some glorious sunset, but having definitely achieved and moved on to a better place in their lives. For me, they are very much saved by the love that they are able to form, and their acts of love and their acts of generosity, despite all the failures, carries them forward, I think, and hopefully enriches their lives.
That's writer Dinah Magestu. He spoke with Steve Scheer about his new book, All Our Names. It's The Record on KUOW.